We are WNST, Tassa Baltimore and Baltimore Positive. We are positively going to take the Maryland Crab Cake Tour back out on the road. I don't know when. And so it'll be in March. How about that? After the extended February that we had here. 10 times the cash. These will be the tickets we'll be giving away. I had John Martin on this week talking about gambling awareness. And we all saw the Saturday Night Live skit last week. You got people out there with a problem. You get them on the phone, the 1-800-GAMBLER. Get some help out there. Our friends at Window Nation are putting us back out on the road. I'll be telling you about windows and doors at 866-90-NATION, Jiffy Lube Multicare, and our newest sponsor, Liberty Pure Water Solutions. Not really a new sponsor, sort of a new old sponsor, but I've been drinking all this clean water. I told Doug I want to scream out that if you're got well water or nasty water, that green water, we can help you out with that. This guy here is in beautiful blue water, sailing calm water, because we got an extra day in February. We are contemplating a spring training run later on this month just because I need some sunshine and Luke needs some baseball. And we all need a holiday, celebrate. But we're not going to talk baseball in this one, although the Orioles did sign a couple of minor leaguers. Let's talk some football here. Luke Jones joins us now. We're not in Indianapolis. I did see that it got to be 60 degrees in Indianapolis, and it figures just when we stop going, global warming and climate change takes over, even in Indianapolis, outside of that little hobbit trail they have there. Yeah, look, the DaCosta-Harbaugh thing now, like, I remember covering these things as a real reporter back in the day where they were gangbangs in the corner. They were not podiums. There was one room with reporters all crowded in, stalking coaches as they came down a ramp at the old Hoosier Dome. This thing's pretty orchestrated now at every level, and bright lights and junior Cub reporters and DaCosta having the script that Chad Steele and the legal department over there from Sashi Brown gave him to talk about Zay. I mean, there's nothing that comes of it other than the things we've been predicting for 60 days. It's amazing. Like, you told me Matt Ibike was getting tagged Thanksgiving, maybe even before that, maybe Halloween. And, you know, the play is playing out now. We're in the first act of the offseason, right?
Yeah. And with each event like this, which, you know, you're not getting major bombshells, you're not getting major headlines, you're getting a couple little nuggets here and there. You start to contextualize what the offseason is going to look like. And, you know, the couple weeks ago, it was Kevin Zeitler's deal voiding, knowing that he's unlikely to be back at this point compared to a month ago when I think most people thought he'd be back. Matt Ibike, to your point, and I wasn't saying it at Halloween, but I definitely was saying it by Thanksgiving, and I wasn't alone in assessing. Look, when you have a guy who leads NFL interior defensive lineman in sacks, has the most sacks by a Ravens player since Terrell Suggs 7-8 years ago, you're not letting him get the market. So, and it was actually Eric DaCosta, kind of his walk-off statement at the end of his 15-20 minute session, whatever it ended up being, and saying, yeah, we're probably going to tag Justin Matabike if we don't get a long-term deal by next week's deadline. So not shocking.
He knows that. I knew you, that. You know, yeah. Everybody knows that, right? Literally.
And that's the thing. I mean, when you're talking about someone who already was betting on himself going into his contract year, as many players, up-and-coming type talents are apt to do, he bet on himself and he won. So it's now a matter of, is he going to get a lucrative contract with the Ravens at some point between now and mid-July, which is the deadline for signing a franchise tag player to a long-term deal, to prevent them playing on the tag on that high $22.1 million number for a defensive tackle? Does he play on the tag? We'll see how it plays out. He's going to get paid one way or the other at some point here, you know, either imminently or at some point in the next, I guess, calendar year, because I'm guessing they wouldn't tag him next year if it comes to it. But Eric DaCosta made clear that that's one of the big priorities. And as I've said, as we've talked about a number of times for years now, probably going back to, I don't know, the days of Haloti Ngata, how rare it is to find that interior pass rusher, how it's like a unicorn. You know, you can find edge guys, but the problem is in this day and age, so many quarterbacks get the ball out quickly that those what used to be sacks are now just pressures coming from the edge. And that's still valuable, don't misconstrue, but when you have that guy that can line up, you know, whether it's off the nose, whether it's a three technique like Matt Ibike primarily, and they can get to the quarterback and bring the quarterback down, I mean, that changes everything. You know, we talked about that years ago with Tom Brady. What was it? What was said about him? You couldn't necessarily sack him coming off the edge, but you can move his feet. And if you make Brady move his feet in the pocket, that throws him off rhythm. And that changed the Patriots passing game pretty dramatically at times, you know, when you were able to do it. So
well, that, I mean, the stats are great, right? To say sack, sack, sack. And that's so unusual. And John Randall and Warren Sapp, we could talk about guys that could play in the inside. Sam Adams wasn't bad at it either. You mentioned Elodie Nada around here. We're familiar with that. But and Aaron Donald sort of perfected it, right, in the modern era. But the just getting a quarterback off the spot, Lamar wants to be off the spot, or did before this year, maybe less this year, but creating less space for the quarterback and being just the word disruptive, whatever disruptive would mean to a play, changing the play, changing the dynamic of the play when you go back and break it down an eye in the sky later on and say that first step, second step, third step, if the quarterback has to move, you've already disrupted them. They could still throw a touchdown pass, right? I mean, you know, in Lamar's case, he could run for a touchdown, right? But being disruptive in that way, that's as effective as sacking to me if you do it more often. And I think he's as disruptive as he is stat-driven. You know, we see the stats. There are a lot of other plays he was disruptive where he didn't get to the quarterback.
No question about it. I mean, and that's really become such a big debate in the modern day in terms of sacks versus pressure and pressure rate and hurries and quarterback hits. Look, at the end of the day, you want to be a player who can finish off plays, right? I mean, you can pressure a quarterback, but if it's a quarterback that's really good in the pocket, or as you mentioned, in the case of a Lamar Jackson, someone who off script is just as good, if not more dangerous, than just standing in the pocket, you know, that's one thing, but you want to be able to bring the quarterback down too. So Matabike's shown an ability to do that. At the same time, I think it's important, and this is where I think we've seen pass rush evaluation change or evolve a little bit in recent years, because you have sites like PFF, Next Gen Stats, all these different sites that are measuring pressure rate, pass rush win rate, things of that nature, that give you a little bit more of a complete picture, rather than just saying, oh, this guy had 8 sacks. I mean, you can literally have a player who doesn't make a huge down-to-down impact as a pass rusher, but just the stars aligned on a set number of plays and they bring down the quarterback. And that looks really good, but maybe that's not a complete picture of the player. Think about late career Chris Davis, okay? And I'm not talking about the very end. I'm talking about like 2016, 2017, before it completely fell apart. He was still hitting home runs, but you weren't seeing as much of everything else, right? So, you know, I'll give you another baseball example. You can have an infielder who has a really great fielding percentage, but if he has no range, is he really a good infielder? No. So I think that's where you kind of look at a pass rusher and say, okay, beyond those 8 sacks, 10 sacks, or in a Matabike's case, 13 sacks, what else were they doing to be impactful? And I think that's where you're looking at this. And, you know, certainly the fact that he blew up and had 13 sacks as opposed to, I think, what, 5.5 had been his career high prior to that, which, you know, he was really good in 2022 also. He just didn't finish quite as many plays. But that's all part of the evaluation. But to bring it back specifically to Matabike, it's just so rare to have that kind of player. That's why Aaron Donald is already widely regarded as maybe the best defensive tackle in NFL history. I mean, that's how that guy is viewed at this point now, as he's, you know, certainly well into the back nine of his career. You look at someone like Chris Jones in Kansas City, franchise tag, and certainly a lot of, you know, effort that they're going to try to bring him back, you know, and we'll see if the Chiefs are able to do it. But what he's been able to do as a pass rusher, I mean, that's rare. And I think that's something for a Ravens defense that is going to undergo some change. We know already on the coaching side, they've undergone a lot of change. But understanding the free agents that they have, guys that are likely to walk, maybe they can bring back one of Clowney or Van Noy. I'd be shocked if they're bringing back both, given their cap. Matabike is someone I think they view as a pillar kind of player for them moving forward. And he's certainly going to be paid that way, whether it's in Baltimore or whether it's somewhere else at some point in time. That's why I've said I'd be shocked whatever the long-term deal is, whether it's with the Ravens or whether it's with another team down the line, I'd be shocked if he's signing a long-term deal that's not at least approaching $100 million. I mean, that's just what kind of player we're talking about here. So it might be 90, might be 4 years, 90, when it's all said and done, but it's going to be very expensive. It's going to be lucrative. You're going to be talking about if Justin Madubike is a Raven long-term in terms of average annual value, he's going to be the second highest paid player on the team behind Lamar Jackson, of course. So the franchise tag always felt inevitable to me. Again, they have until next week. Preferably, yeah, you'd like him to sign a long-term deal because a long-term deal year one in 2024 would be much cheaper on the cap than what that $22.1 million tag is going to cost. But Madubike knows that. His representation knows that. And as we've said year after year after year, you can go back and play the tape from previous years. When you're talking about a player, especially of that ilk, this close to free agency, we're now just a couple weeks out from the start of the new league year, really tough to keep them off market. So the only device, the only tool the Ravens currently have, other than just giving him whatever he wants for a long-term deal, is to use the franchise tag. And again, Eric DaCosta confirmed that that's likely to be the case. And if Eric DaCosta is saying it's likely, you can bet that that's all but guaranteed at this point in time. So we'll just see how these next few days play out, but certainly expecting Madubike to be tagged if there is no long-term deal, which again, tough to get a long-term deal done when you're this close to the start of free agency. Any of those players are at least representing the idea that they want to try to get to market, even if it's not going to happen.
Well, you only marry the girls you love. I mean, so if they really are seriously offering them $100 million and you're in the way that they loved Roquan Smith before they met him, literally, and they love Marlon Humphrey, they loved Ronnie Stanley, the people they marry in that way, I'm wondering in Madubike's case, I mean, I wonder that as a fan, as an observer of it, is saying, is he, they didn't love Matt Judon like that. They didn't, they didn't want it. And any player that signed somewhere else, whether it's Kyle Juszczyk running around a decade later, if they love them, they would have married them. And they speak that language. And they shall with Linderbaum, and they will with Kyle Hamilton, and they did with Humphrey and Stanley and Mark Andrews, right? And Lamar. So I do wonder aloud. Do they want to tag him and let somebody else pay him that and squeeze out whatever they get for 21 million this year? Because they would play it that way with Judon. They've played it that way with other guys. I'm just wondering, are they in love with him or not? Do they really want to sign him to a lot of money? Because that is a good question for the middle of the interior line when there's going to be a lot of other questions coming down the line.
Well, and look, I mean, all those other contracts that you just spelled out, other than Lamar himself, those were all signed with Lamar Jackson on a rookie contract. The reality is, at this point in time, you need to be, you're much more aware of your salary cap. You have much more scrutiny for any players on your roster, whether you're talking about those other four to five guys, five, six guys, whatever it is that have premier contracts in addition to your franchise quarterback who has an average annual value of what, $52 million a year. Even though the cap number isn't at that level just yet, it's still something that you're, from a long-term planning standpoint, you have to be aware of. So I've thought this, I've opined about this. We've talked about this on the air at a couple of different points over the last couple of years. I think there's certainly some merit to the idea of being not reluctant that you don't want Justin Madubike long-term, but at what cost? Every player has value. Every player has cost. Every player has a label in terms of what you perceive. Great example right now, and you're hearing it right now. CJ Mosley, what's going to happen with him with the Jets? I mean, this is his fifth year of that contract. Remember, it was bumped back a year because he opted out during the COVID year, but lots of questions as far as that cap number. He's their captain. The Jets love CJ Mosley. The Ravens really liked CJ Mosley, but they didn't like him at the cost that he was going to go to the Jets. Back in what, 2019 now, 5 years ago.
Wasn't over a lot of money. That was more, I mean, the Ravens offered a lot of money and the Ravens really wanted him. That was not like a joke. They weren't trying to short shrift him. The Jets just came in and banged out another million and a half a year, as I remember it,
I
right?
mean, I can't remember the exact discrepancy, but it was real. I mean, it
Well,
wasn't,
a million and a half isn't, I'm not saying,
yeah.
but I'm What I'm saying is the Ravens would have loved if CJ signed the deal that they put in front of him for whatever the price was, because they loved him. They weren't trying to lowball him or say, hey, get lost. They were like, we think you're a $14 million linebacker and the Jets think you're a $16 million linebacker. Go there. You know what I mean? And they've done that with a lot of guys at that level. And that's why I feel like everybody can't be Haloti Ngata. You know, at some point, Patrick Queen's going to go get paid somewhere else because they made that decision. Doesn't make him less of a football player. It just means like we can only afford so much. And that's where my rich blood would say, you know, long term, 2 years from now, do you want Kyle Hamilton or do you want Justin Madubuike?
Yeah.
Because they're both going to be $20 million players.
Yeah, but the reality is 2 years from now, Ronnie Stanley's probably not going to be around. I mean, we're talking about him not being around this year. Marlon Humphrey, who knows what's going to happen with him at that point in time. I mean, you know, so it's always a living canvas, right? I mean, the roster, and it's always evolving. Guys that were slam dunks five years ago to be on the team, like Ronnie Stanley, were certainly, you know, we're now talking about in very different terms. I mean, Marlon Humphrey we're viewing differently now than 2 or 3 years ago. So, I mean, that's just the evolution of it. And when you have a franchise quarterback at the top of your salary cap in terms of cap number, you have to be a little more discerning. You have to be a little more critical in how you look at it. You have a smaller margin for error. It's not an excuse. It's not to say, oh, we have a franchise quarterback, we can't pay this guy. No, you can pay certain guys, but you have to identify how much you're going to go, what kind of structure. Are you going to use void years and things like that to kick the can down the road in terms of salary cap? That's just part of it. So for me, I think there's a fair question, not so much that you don't want Madubuike. I mean, he's coming off a 13 sack season. You know, that would be silly to say you don't want him. However, is there some merit to the idea of if you can make it work and you can restructure some other deals and you make some tough calls, cutting some other guys like, you know, Tyus Bowser comes to mind right away, to save enough from a cap standpoint to carry that tag number, because you want to see Madubuike do it again. And that doesn't mean he has to match 13 sacks again, but you don't want it to drop back down to 5.5, right? You know, you don't want that to be, if it's his career year, fine, but you don't want 13 to drop back down to 5.5. If it's 13 this past year, and then he has 10 or 11 sacks this year, then I think you feel, and assuming the pass rush rate, you know, win rate and pressures and all that stuff, then you feel like, okay, this is who he is. This is legit. He's done it 2 years in a row. He didn't set a career high again, but he's double-digit sacks again. Then, to me, at that point, and he would also be saying at that point, well, the price probably went up from where it was a year ago. But then I think you're much more comfortable with the idea of marrying him long-term at a deal that's approaching $100 million, whatever it is. And again, I'm spitballing here. We don't know exactly what it's going to shake out to be, but
on him coming out of college, they've moved past all that, right? I mean,
he's developed, you know, I mean, he's a third round pick. You know, no third round pick is going to come out and be a completely clean prospect. I mean, that you know, especially talking about a defensive tackle with some pass rush ability. I mean,
well, especially a guy we're comparing to Aaron Donald right now.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he's not Aaron Donald.
The day I met Aaron Donald, Phil Savage introduced me to him in Mobile, Alabama, and told me that guy's going to the Hall of Fame. Like, literally, that's what Savage told me. Phil Savage said, we have a guy named Aaron Donald here. He's going to emcee. He's going to speak for all the players. You're going to see him. You're going to be really – he's from Pittsburgh. You're going to be really impressed by him. He's going to go to the Hall of Fame one day. He's the best player here. That's what Phil told me. So – Phil knows things.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I can still remember that was the same year as CJ Mosley. It was 2014. I remember. And I remember some Ravens fans being upset because I think Mosley finished second in Defensive Rookie of the Year that year. And I, you know, nothing against CJ. He had a really good rookie year. And I think he even made the Pro Bowl that year as a rookie. But I felt like anyone who was saying that was, you know, it was kind of a case of, did you watch Aaron Donald play at all this year? Like, that guy's, he's a unicorn. I mean, you could see it right away.
He showed up. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but point is.
But other guys take time, right? And then you say to yourself, is he flashing? Was it a product of our defense? You know, is he going to be motivated after we pay him? Which is a question you ask anybody, anytime.
It's fair, right? And I can't help but think, not that the Ravens would feel this way, but if you're a Ravens fan that has taken some pause, and again, it's not that you don't like Madubuike, it's the idea of paying him $90 million, 95, whatever it ends up being. There is some thought, at least in my mind, of look what happened with Broderick Washington this past year. Now, Broderick Washington's not remotely the same player as Justin Madubuike, but same draft class, similar story, guy who popped in his third season. You know, Washington had a really good year in 2022. I mean, there were some fans and people that just looked at it, you know, on a more casual level, not a level like the Ravens would be evaluating, who kind of thought, you know what, I'll take this guy because he's going to be a little bit cheaper than Madubuike. And he had a really good 2022 season. Well, we saw what happened this year. I mean, Broderick Washington was a non-factor for them up front. I mean, to the point where, if you recall that Thursday night game against the Bengals, he was a healthy scratch in that game. Now, that was the only time that happened all year. But the point is, he got paid last August, albeit a much more modest contract. I think it was $16 million, $17 million over a few years. So we're not talking about dramatically high money, but he didn't have a great year on the heels of getting an extension. So I think there's at least a few fans out there. And look, I think most fans absolutely want to keep Justin Madubuike around. And let's be clear, we're not talking about him going to free agency. We're talking about a scenario where maybe you want to see him do it again, and he does play on the tag. Problem is, that wreaks havoc on your cap and your ability to roster build, and it does make things more challenging. So, yeah, we'll see how it plays out. But, yeah, Eric DaCosta, the biggest headline from Tuesday's session in Indy, where there weren't many headlines, as we said, it's definitely Madubuike getting the tag if there's not going to be a long-term deal. I think they're still hoping. It sounds like they're still talking, but how realistic is that? I mean, you see it year by year. This time of year, talking about guys that are getting the franchise tag, how often do you see them sign a long-term deal, agree to a long-term deal in late February and early March before that deadline for the tag? That doesn't happen too often. I mean, around the league, maybe you'll find one per year, but generally speaking, those guys aren't signing anything before the deadline for the tag, and then they end up playing this game of chicken that can go all the way through the middle of July.
He's Luke Jones. He's Baltimore Luke. You can find him out anywhere the interweb is served. We're in a little downtime with an extra day in February into sort of a quiet March week. I am re-releasing the Peter Principles currently at Baltimore Positive. We're getting some new ownership for the baseball team, as well as not just recapping the past there, but also the Free the Birds movement that's now 18 years old. If the birds are actually going to be freed, it was a book about my father, my love of baseball, my father's love of baseball and taking me to games. 19 chapters that I'm going to be releasing for my father's birthday, which is Tuesday, March 5th. My dad would have been 105 years old. So, my dad loved the Orioles, and we will take a little walk down memory lane. I'm actually going through some of the pictures and releasing them. There's a little documentary being put together about our history here in 25 years. So big appreciation to Curio and Foreign Daughter as well for sponsoring our 25th anniversary and our 25 Stories of Glory. One thing that Luke brought up gloriously a couple of days ago on the program was wondering if I really knew what the salary cap was in 1996 when John Ogden and Ray Lewis came in. And I found this beautiful picture of David Modell and I at the barn really, really early on. And I'm going to be sharing a whole bunch of old memories of all that. But cap number and the cap number going up a little bit and questions for DaCosta and where they are that they would have a couple of million bucks more to throw at a Madubuike or to throw at a contract or wherever it would be around the edges of the roster. They knew this money was coming, I guess. I mean, I don't think there's any secrets for Pat Moriarty or, you know, within the league numbers to know how much money they're making and how that's going to affect the cap. I think they knew that when they signed Lamar. It always goes up, just like the season ticket renewals do. Leonard Raskin and I discussed that as well. But that cap number and that little bit of money, and I had Dennis on this week for the first time in a long time, and Dennis and I were talking about the importance of the draft and, like, you got to get a starter or two out of the draft. You got to get impact players out of the draft, especially once you start giving this money to Lamar Jackson. And then you and I are talking about, do they love Madubuike? Should they love Madubuike? Should they love Hamilton more? Should they love Linderbaum more? Like, where are they in all of this? And, oh, by the way, I guess at the heart of all of this, if you and I were chasing DaCosta around Indianapolis and Harbaugh was giving us free rides in his taxi cab, we'd be talking about the offensive line right now, because that's really that's the story for them. And it's, well, you got some money back from Zeitler and you're going to figure your money out with Stanley, but who's going to be on the field?
Yeah, I mean, it's a big question. I mean, John Harbaugh even acknowledged, I mean, it's the, quote, most important thing we do on offense is going to be rebuilding the offensive line. I think the question is right now, to what degree are you rebuilding it? The only set known commodity where you say, no questions about it, he's going to be on the field week one, assuming he's healthy, is who? Tyler Linderbaum. After that, it's kind of a mystery. Now, let's be clear. Ronnie Stanley is under contract. Morgan Moses is under contract for one more year. Morgan Moses, his cap number is doable, right? It's not a major value concern. It's more a question of his age, the fact that he had some injuries this past year, a guy who was very durable for a decade. And as I always say, unfortunately with football, because it's a 100% injury rate, guys are durable until they're not anymore. And that's where you start to run the question. But Zeitler, barring something, you know, a change of heart on one side or the other over the next couple of weeks,
or another team to give him more money.
Well, that's my point. I mean, it's
not a change of heart. It's a change of market, right? Oh, I mean, it just takes one, right?
Like, yeah, well, but that's my point. I mean, it's, you know, unless the Ravens change their mind or unless he says whatever the Ravens say is okay, he's going to hit market and someone's going to pay him a 2 or 3 year contract, I'm guessing, even at age 34, because he played at a high level this past year. So you're going to be replacing him most likely. John Simpson, their left guard, is also a free agent. You know, I don't think that one is, he was the weak link of their five starters, but he started all 17 games, all 19 counting the playoffs, and it's another starter you need to replace. So you look at the internal options. I'm sorry, I look at them at offensive tackle right now. I don't see Daniel Faalele as a starter, at least in 2024. I think Patrick McCary is what he is, which is that extremely valuable guy who can start at really all five offensive line spots in a pinch, but not someone that you're penciling in to be your starting left tackle. At least that's how I view it. So, you know, it's great to say you want to rebuild your offensive line, but here's the reality, Nestor. You're picking 30th. Jonathan Ogden was the fourth overall pick in the 1996 draft. Ronnie Stanley was the sixth overall pick in the 2016 draft. I mean, Jared Gaither started for a minute, and I get it. He was a supplemental draft pick years and years ago stepped in after Jonathan Ogden, but that was a short-term fix. And, you know, Jared Gaither wasn't a long-term answer there. My point is not that you can't find the left tackle of the future, 30th overall, which is where the Ravens are picking, but is that going to be a guy that's ready to start week one of his rookie year? That's a big risk you're talking about there. So I think I've been talking about this as much as anyone, you know, going back to the middle of the season when it was clear that Ronnie Stanley was struggling, staying healthy again and struggling to perform at the same level we had grown accustomed to him being 4 or 5 years ago. But it's easier said than done to replace him in terms of finding someone that's going to be, one, an upgrade, two, even as good as him right now. And look, I know that's not, people are going to roll their eyes and say that's not the highest bar, but Ronnie Stanley wasn't the worst left tackle in football this year or anything like that. Let's be clear. He wasn't the $20-plus million player that the Ravens signed him to be, but he wasn't the worst in the league either. So you're talking about still replacing a certain level of production. And I get it. He hasn't been on the field for 17 games. I understand that, but it's still easier said than done replacing that player. And certainly from a standpoint of replacing that player immediately. So I'll continue to say that when I look at this picture, I have a tough time believing the Ravens are going to replace three starters, let alone four starters on the offensive line. So,
and I don't think they want to be trading from 13 up to 17 because the third best tackle is there and they see him as, they see three tackles and say, we could any of these three. And the one guy falls to 12, 14, 16. I mean, you're in 30. Trading up from 30 looks like the one next year, no matter what.
Well, and that's the thing. And then you go back to what you were just saying.
You need to draft in order to get around Lamar, right? Is that what you're thinking?
Well, it's what you said that you were discussing with Dennis. I mean, you're at a point now when you consider where the salary cap is. And it helps that it went up to $255 million as opposed to 240 or 245. That helps. But keep in mind, that helps all 32 teams. So it's still relative. When the salary cap goes up as much as it did for the Ravens, what it's really good for is fixed commodities that were already on your payroll, already on your salary cap, are now more valuable. Lamar Jackson, the more and more the salary cap is going to go up in the coming years, that deal will look like, relatively speaking, let's be clear, because it sounds silly saying this about any player with a $250-plus million contract, it becomes more of a bargain. Mark Andrews' contract is more of a bargain now than it was a week ago, with the salary cap being $30 million less than what it is now.
Well, it also makes Stanley's less of a liability, too.
It does. No, it does. It absolutely does. So you view it through that lens. Matabike, I mean, my biggest takeaway when the cap went up to $255 million, I said this to you when we talked a few days earlier, was for me, that makes tagging Matabike less prohibitive than it would have under a $240 or $245 million cap. So point is, I think it's going to be really challenging, given where they are from a cap standpoint, given where they are in terms of draft capital, picking 30th, you're picking very late in each round. You know, I think it's very ambitious to think that you're going to sit there and replace more than a couple starters on your offensive line. Now, I already said, for me, the ideal scenario, I've said this, I've written this, I'll continue to say this until it doesn't happen, because I'm not that smart and the Ravens will have a plan that's different than mine, and that's fine. But I still view this through the lens of the best way to proceed with Ronnie Stanley and the left tackle picture for 2024, I think, is to try to work out a deal where he takes a pay cut, add in incentives to try to make him whole. The reality is, and people would say, well, he can say no to that. Well, I would say good luck getting the kind of money that the Ravens potentially pay you with incentives out on the market, considering how the last 3 years of your career have gone. I mean, it's just, I'm not trying to be mean. It's just the reality for where he is at this point, health-wise and performance-wise. So take a pay cut, build in incentives for him. If he's healthy, if he's playing at a high level, you make him whole. In the meantime, that gives you some cap relief. And for me, then, I'm looking, whether we're talking about 30th overall, whether we're talking about a day two pick, I mean, obviously we're not talking about picking someone in the fifth round here, but you identify a guy that you think could be your left tackle of the future, but he doesn't have to play day one, week one, and maybe it becomes a Jonathan Ogden scenario where he plays left guard for a year, or maybe he plays
my
right
hand
tackle.
Here on Ronnie Stanley, if he hit the market next week, would anybody sign him for anything?
Yeah, I mean, he's not, again, let's be clear.
But the perception of injury, the perception of where he is for another team, would they look at him and say, I'm going to invest $30 million for 2 years in him or whatever we're going to bring him in and give him guaranteed money and guarantee that he's going to beat out the left tackle that we already have, who's 10 years younger and less money. I mean, Zeitler's different for me because I think he's perceived as being captain of the ship, and the way Calais Campbell went and got a job last year in that way that he could still play. I don't know with Ronnie Stanley that, if to your point, you want to renegotiate with him and rub his back and bring him back in. My question is, do they want him to be the left tackle this year for Lamar? Is he the guy you want out there in week 12 in December on a, you know, 9-5 football to whatever they're going to be at that point? Is he the guy you want to be your left tackle next season? Matabike, yes, for all the reasons we talked about, at whatever price, maybe they don't want him to be that guy 3 years from now. Ronnie Stanley. Yeah, you know, my question is, do they want him on the field, and would another team want him?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fair question. At the same time, I mean, you're not drafting Trent Williams 30th overall. You know, I mean, you're not drafting the next Jonathan Ogden 30th overall. So it's great to say you want someone better. It's another thing to be able to go get that guy. So
went out and signed that guy the way they brought Morgan Moses in and said, we brought Ronnie Stanley and we fixed our left tackle. I would call Bujal on that if I'm the sports radio guy in Minneapolis. Yeah. Pick the city. Pick any city. If you're telling me you're bringing that guy in and saying that guy is going to be our reliable starting left tackle for any price, even if it was cheap, I'd say, okay, you better draft somebody at 30. That's what I would say.
At the same time, that there aren't 32 great franchise left tackles in the league. So a team that had a worse situation than the Ravens last year, which, again, Ronnie Stanley was not the worst left tackle in the league. I want to be clear about this. They'll look at him and say, you know what? He was healthier this past year. Look, he only missed he only missed four games, five games, whatever it was, compared to the year before that. And certainly the year before that, we might take an $8 million flyer on this guy. And I'm just throwing $8 million out there. I'm throwing it out there because that's how much the Ravens paid Alejandro Villanueva a couple years ago.
Well, and you're just throwing it out there as well because you'd like for them to go to his agent and say, this is what you're worth right now.
And that's part
play
of
for eight. That is your
part of the dance
the
right
beginning.
Now.
Right.
That's part of the dance right now, where if you're the Ravens, you're saying, okay, how would we assess this player if he hits the open market? And it's weird to say that because he's your guy. You married him a few years back. Obviously, he's been through heck, with the ankle and the recovery and the knee this year. I mean, he's been through a lot.
In the corporate world, they call this right sizing, is what they call it, right?
So, but if you're the Ravens, you're viewing it through the lens of, okay, how would we value this player if he hit the open market? And then they're doing that with the thought in mind of, presumably, if you want to do this. Now, it's possible they might just say, we're done with Ronnie Stanley. We think he was barely holding on this past year. We can't bet on this anymore. We're going to cut him with a post-June 1st designation. Problem with that, yeah, you save more cap space, but you don't get any of it until June. And that's when most of free agency, not all, because Kyle Van Noy and Jadeveon Clowney would beg to differ, most of free agency is over at that point in time. And certainly, that's not going to help you land your next left tackle, with that kind of a scenario. That's why I keep saying, I still think in a vacuum, and again, is that player going to be there at 30th? Is that player going to be there in the second round? Again, these are unknowns. I'm speaking in hypotheticals right now because that's all it is, because we don't know. But I still question and wonder if the best case scenario for them, viewing it through the lens of how difficult it is to find a left tackle, where they are from a salary cap standpoint, where they are in terms of draft capital and where they're picking, if it's to work something out on the short term to alleviate some cap, give Ronnie Stanley another chance, give him some motivation where you say, hey, you cut my pay. Hey, you're giving me some incentives to make it back. I'll show you guys. I'm finally getting healthy. I didn't deal so much with the ankle this past year. I had a knee issue that a MCL injury in week one that I dealt with for the bulk of the year. So it gives him plenty of motivation. And then, like I said, you look to draft someone that you feel can be your left tackle. And let's be clear, I might not even be talking about a scenario where they're your left tackle in 25. It might be someone that might be ready to take over in week 10 if Ronnie Stanley hurts his ankle or his knee or shoulder or something like that. I mean,
but it just can't be McCary for real.
It's right. I mean, and I have a tough time looking at anyone in this draft where you would pick at 30th, or even let's say someone that maybe you'd move up to 23rd to get, right? I mean, to your point, it can be tough to move up more than 5 or 10 spots. If you are, then you are talking about giving up really meaningful future draft capital to get a guy. But, it's going to be really tough to envision someone in that area of the draft where you're just going to say, all right, they're the left tackle. I mean, even when they drafted Michael Orr, and remember, they traded up to draft Michael Orr back in 2009, that was done with the thought of, okay, you do have Jared Gaither at left tackle. They thought at that point, yeah, Michael Orr is probably going to, it's going to be the left tackle of the future. But where did he start? Right tackle that year. So maybe that's the scenario. And if that happens, maybe you're saying goodbye to Morgan Moses under that scenario. And then you can create some cap space doing that. So there are always multiple roads, right? I mean, there's always an alternative to whatever your plan A is. But problem is, again, these are challenging variables that the Ravens are dealing with as it pertains to replacing Ronnie Stanley. So we're going to see how it plays out. But John Harbaugh and Eric DaCosta both said that, it's a big objective. Zeitler's out the door, or at least halfway out the door at this point in time. John Simpson's presumably out the door. I think they do have some legitimate internal options at guard. I think Ben Cleveland is very likely going to be a starter. And I think for as much as people might be rolling their eyes hearing that, when he filled in for Kevin Zeitler the last couple of years, he actually played pretty well. So I think Ben Cleveland can do what Ben Powers did a couple of years ago, which was become a starter. And suddenly you say, hey, after waiting around 3 years, this guy did a pretty nice job.
Well, you wonder who the guards are till Matabike shows up on the other side, or you have to go play Aaron Donald.
Right. Yeah.
And you lose a playoff game because of that, because your quarterback can't operate. Right.
Yeah,
I mean, having the O-line, the difference between the Bengals being champions and the Chiefs a couple of years ago not being champions, like literally.
Absolutely. So, you know, we'll see how that plays out, though, with Ben Cleveland. Andrew Voorhees, keep in mind, they drafted him in the 7th round last year. He was the kid who tore his ACL at the combine. He was considered a mid-round pick out of USC, multi-year starter in the Pac-12, which doesn't mean anything now, but a couple years ago, it still meant something. But, you know, he's another candidate. Big Sala. So they have some guard candidates. Offensive tackle, that's where if you are replacing these veteran players, boy, there's a lot of work to do it. I'm just saying.
Luke Jones is a Baltimore. Luke, we'll give our NFL team report cards at some point, maybe early next week. See if old Steve gets an A from Ness. Maybe I'll deliver his report card to him at the owners' meetings later on this month. Luke can be found at Baltimore Luke. I can be found anywhere the internet travels. A lot of you are finding us in lots of ways at YouTube. You're subscribing, downloading, listening, podcasting, Apple and Spotifying, and doing all the things that you're doing. We do appreciate the sponsorship from all of our sponsors, including Royal Farms in my Cole Roofing mug here. We got all sorts of things happening. The Maryland Lottery putting us out on the road for the Maryland Crab Cake Tour, along with Window Nation, Jiffy Lube, and our friends at Liberty Pure Solutions. I'll be telling you more, showing you more, and doing more as the Orioles get ready to play opening day later on in the month. The Ravens get ready for the Underwear Olympics to be over with, and the free agent Olympics to begin. The owners' meetings are later on this month. We got a lot of sports things happening around here. We did a lot of charity last month as well. You can find all of it at WNST AM 1570 Towson, Baltimore, where we never stop talking Baltimore positive.